I'm excited to invite you to the Reset Your Nervous System Super Conference, a very special free online event happening July 21st through the 27th, 2025. During this one-of-a-kind event, 60-plus internationally renowned health and wellness experts will share their unmatched wisdom and proven healing modalities for regulating your nervous system, switching off your maladaptive stress response, and cultivating physical, mental, and emotional well-being. We're talking brilliant thinkers and healers like Gabor Maté, Britt Frank, Dr. Daniel Siegel, Dr. Richard Schwartz, and Dr. Stephen Porges, just to name a few. Grab your seat to this free conference. You'll find the link to sign up in the show notes.
Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a compassionate guide for those seeking to heal and thrive. Introducing your host, Monique Coven, a certified trauma recovery coach and fellow traveler on the path to healing. In this podcast, we will engage in heartfelt conversation with experts in the field of trauma healing. We'll explore ways to cultivate feeling safe in our bodies and in connection to others, so that we can be present to live the life we've been given more fully and with more joy. Join us as we navigate the way towards a life restored. Introducing your host, Monique Coven.
This episode I hold really close to my heart. And when I think about all of the really renowned specialists in the field, Dr. Judith Herman means so much to me, and I know it does to all of you as well. She was one of the first people to actually come out with this name that was different from PTSD, complex PTSD, she came up with, realizing that trauma could also be a result of repeated ongoing experiences in childhood and in relationships, and that we needed a separate category. It was her book where she laid this out, her very first book, Trauma and Recovery. And to me, it was like the blinders came off for so many of us when we read that book. And that book still today is a classic and highly recommended for those who are learning about complex trauma and trauma and recovery. So without further ado, enjoy this episode with Dr. Judith Herman.
I am so beyond excited and grateful to have this conversation with you on the podcast. A big welcome to you, Dr. Herman. I'm thrilled. And I guess we'll start with really your book, which has been foundational, just giving us survivors of developmental and complex trauma a name and validation for the first time, and owe you so much gratitude for that. I have my own story about that, which I'll maybe share a little bit, but your book, Trauma and Recovery, was the first book that I went, oh my goodness, this explains what I'm going through. Finally, there's an answer. And so I took that book, actually. Yeah. My story with developmental trauma was happening, at least the symptoms were showing up really around the time your book came out. I was a young mom and I was experiencing very typical PTSD symptoms from developmental trauma, and was going from therapist at that time to therapist and not really getting anywhere. And finally, I said, all right, I'm going to go to the expert of experts, which is a doctor of psychiatry, and they're going to tell me what's happening. So I went to see a psychiatrist. I was very ashamed. I'm sorry to say that, but I was, because in my mind, I had a lot of thoughts around that. But I figured I'm going to do it because they're going to help me. They're going to name it. And I went and I did some testing, and she came back and said, you have anxiety. I'm sure you heard this a million times, right? Yeah. And I'm like, oh, okay, help me. What can we do? And basically it was, you need to do CBT. And I spent the next many years being told, you really need to do CBT. And one day I read your book And I walked in with your book and I went, I think I know what's going on. I just read this book and I think I have complex PTSD. And she had a face that had no expression.
Yeah.
And we left it at that. And I continued for a couple of years until I just dropped the subject and then stopped going. And then found my own private psychiatrist and psychologist that evaluated me. And I had complex trauma. So thank you for everything that you have done. So can you tell us about how your book came to be?
Trauma and Recovery.
Yes, your first book. We'll talk about the second book after.
Well, let me back up because that was actually my second book. My first book was published in 1981, and it was called Father-Daughter Incest. I owe that and everything else in my career to the women's liberation movement. It's as simple as that. I was in the consciousness-raising group at the same time that I was doing my residency in the early 1970s. And my first two patients on the inpatient service were women who'd made suicide attempts, and they both told me, they both disclosed histories of father-daughter incest. And at that time, the Comprehensive Textbook of Psychiatry estimated the prevalence of all incest cases at 1 per million. Well, it was a, you know, maybe 1 in 100, so they were only off by 4 orders of magnitude, but the received opinion at that time was that this is what women fantasized about.
Freud.
Yeah, it went back to Freud's repudiation of his original discovery, which was that hysteria, as it was then called, originated in childhood sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. But I had been listening to the women in my consciousness raising group, and this was a pretty privileged group of white college educated women, and there was quite a bit of sexual domestic violence in people's experiences. And so I validated what my patients were telling me, and guess what? They started to get better, you know? So everything really grew from that. By the time after that book was published in the early 90s, I also joined the Department of Psychiatry at Cambridge Hospital, which was really just begun an affiliation with Harvard Medical School and become a teaching hospital. And it was a very creative place at that time. And so when the city of Cambridge appropriated $6,000 for services for crime victims, and, you know, the people running the department were all guys and they weren't interested in that. Mm-hmm. They hired me and a psychologist named Mary Harvey to do that. And that's how we started the Victims of Violence Program. And so there we were seeing lots more survivors of sexual and domestic violence, both men and women, mostly women. And so it's at that time that I began participating in a study group that was being organized by my colleague, Bessel van der Kolk, about trauma in different populations. He was working with combat vets, other people. Anyway, he invited people who were working with abused kids and burn victims and all sorts of natural disasters. And we were trying to study the common features of trauma. What became clear was that interpersonal violence had much more profound effects than, say, an auto accident or a natural disaster, that there was a spectrum of post-traumatic stress that went from a single incident that was not malicious, you know, that was truly an accident or a, you know, act of God, to single incident interpersonal violence, to mm-hmm. prolonged and repeated interpersonal violence, and then at the extreme end, you know, prolonged and repeated abuse starting in childhood, you know, and that at that end of the spectrum, it was a much more complicated picture than just, you know, the triad of hyperarousal, intrusive memories, mm-hmm. or nightmares, and a numbness. That those were the common features of PTSD across the spectrum, but that the further you went out in the spectrum, where these were consequences of extreme interpersonal violence over a long period of time, you saw much more impact on relationships, identity, mm-hmm. the person's sense mm-hmm. of being deserving to live. So that's really what led to my developing the concept of complex PTSD. And then when you went back and looked at what people meant by hysteria in the 19th century, it was complex PTSD. So Freud was right the first time.
Yeah. And wasn't there something about him talking about it being, it was sexual abuse, and then he went back to what's...
Yes, that's right. He published a paper in 1896 called The Etiology of Hysteria. And he compared it to the discovery of the source of the Nile. This was the era of colonial exploration. This was going to be the big discovery in psychiatry. And mm-hmm. he was completely ostracized by his peers. It wasn't just, he was talking about, you know, his patients were kind of the upper bourgeoisie of Vienna. So, you know, how could mm-hmm. that possibly
wow.
be? And so he retracted. Mm-hmm. He was an ambitious guy. And he wanted recognition. And if this wasn't going to be the source of the Nile, he wasn't going to go. He wasn't going to go there. You know, I don't think anybody can deal with trauma when they're isolated. Mm-hmm. That goes for patients and it goes for, psychiatrists.
So for sure. Yeah. Wow. So that, that your book coming out, just like I said, it for all of us who were experiencing that and didn't have words or recognition or validation, now we had it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's a surprise to you that it's still like it's taken a long time. I mean, you wrote that 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's taken time for people to grab onto that, for it to be taught. I don't even know if it's taught in universities.
It is, but trauma in general is still under-recognized mm-hmm. in the mental health professions, I think. It's given the prevalence, given, how widespread it is. It should be part of, Psych 101. Sometimes it is, but a lot of times it isn't still. And there again, I think it does really take the argument in trauma and recovery was that it takes a political movement.
Mm.
To validate or recognize survivors. And that if you don't have that, then you can't, people prefer to look the other way. Now it's an ugly topic.
Mm-hmm.
People don't want to deal with it if mm-hmm. they don't have to. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think, when you see something like Black Lives Matter or the Me Too movement, you're going to get a lot more awareness than when you're dealing with the backlash.
Yeah. So now your new book that's coming out in March next month.
Yeah.
And it is called, I have it in front of me, Truth and Repair, How Trauma Survivors Envision Justice. I was telling you before we recorded, the whole thing is underlined. There's so much in there. Where do you want to begin with that? I mean, I have like, even my first page, I've got like all these things that really stuck out for me. Apology and how, and the recognition and what survivors really want. And so where do you want to take this? There's so much.
Well, maybe we can pick up with the idea that you need a social movement.
Okay.
To really have recognition for survivors. Mm-hmm. Because, and I really do think of Truth and Repair is kind of a sequel to Trauma and Recovery, because if the argument in Trauma and Recovery is true, which I really think it is, and that is that this is not an individual psychological problem. I mean, it is, yes, it is that as well for survivors, but but it's a social problem and a political problem as well. And so if that's true, then recovery can't just be an individual matter. Mm-hmm. You know, there has to be some social healing as well as individual healing.
Yeah.
And so that's really what led me to this idea that, you know, maybe beyond the three stages of individual recovery that I kind of outlined, there's a fourth stage, which has to do with social healing. And, if trauma originates in an injustice, well, then doesn't recovery involve justice? And, I mean, I think I was led to this also by my patients, because all the patients we saw at Victims of Violence Program, mm-hmm. because, you know, they, a lot of times, they felt as hurt by the way the bystanders behaved,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or even more so than by what the perpetrator did. Mm-hmm. You know, all the people that enabled the perpetrator, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. chose to look the other way, yeah. didn't believe them or, you know, blame them,
yeah.
you know, basically allowed this to happen.
Yes. Yeah. I picked that up in the book and I was like, yes, I haven't heard anybody name that. And as you did, I'm like, yes, because even when I think about it, there's the perpetrator, but then there's what you're describing. Mm-hmm. There, that comes to mind a lot.
Yeah. And a lot of times, I mean, that started also with the first book about incest, because a lot of the survivors we interviewed for that book were much more hurt by what their mothers did or didn't do.
Yeah.
They, you know, they felt abandoned by their mothers. Now, a lot of times, the mothers were not in any position to protect them because they were ill themselves, physical illnesses, mental illness, addiction, and a lot of them were battered. And but to the from the point of view of a kid, my mom is the one who's supposed to take care of me and look out for me. The fact that she may be totally disempowered herself or totally terrorized doesn't enter into it. It was like, where was my mom? Where was my mom? And if they wanted healing, a lot of times that's who they wanted it with. Mm-hmm. You know, they wanted, mm-hmm. one of the things that I did with a close colleague, Emily Schatzo, was we developed kind of a protocol for family disclosures and family confrontations for a lot of survivors as adults, you know, had been warned never to say anything as children, and they were too afraid.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Frightened, but they, as adults, they wanted to tell their mothers or their sisters. And so we realized that that kind of healing was very important. She had a lot of family therapy experience. So we kind of developed a method for preparing people for those encounters. And sometimes they happened in our offices. And we saw how important that was. And a lot of them, I mean, some people wanted to confront the perpetrators, but a much smaller number than wanted the healing with their mothers. And so that was kind of our model for doing the necessary healing work with bystanders.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you're generalizing to wider forms of violence and exploitation, that's what we saw over and over, that the survivors, first of all, they wanted the truth to be out there.
Yeah.
That was everybody. I interviewed 30 survivors of either child abuse, sexual assault, sexual harassment, sex trafficking, intimate partner violence, the whole spectrum of, you know, crimes, gender-based violence, basically. Mm-hmm. And mostly women, but a few men as well. And that every one of them, the first thing they wanted was they wanted the truth out there, and they wanted the truth to be validated. That is to say, not just the facts, but the harm, because the fallback position for the perpetrators, if they can't, denial and secrecy aren't going to work anymore. So what's the big deal? Get over it. You know, why are you whining now? That was a long time ago. Forgive and forget. Well, you were always a little mentally off, you know, saying either that or you asked for it, you know. So so they wanted the shame and the blame placed where it belonged. So they wanted the crime to be recognized and the harm to be recognized, and they wanted the public to denounce the crime and say, you didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
The perpetrator is the one who's responsible. And that was the big thing that everybody wanted. And then when it went past that, people were mixed about, you know, well, so what should happen? What would make things right? Surprisingly, punishment didn't come up a lot. Money didn't come up a lot. Revenge didn't come up a lot. Mm-hmm. And forgiveness didn't come up a lot. Some people wanted an apology from the perpetrator. A lot of people didn't. A lot of people said, I would never trust an apology from him anyway. He's not capable. You know, it would just be he'd be lying. One woman said, she'd been abused by her brother. I think he'd enjoy talking about what he did, you know? And then she said, and anyway, if he apologized, then I'd be under pressure to forgive him. And I don't want that. Some people did want an apology. Very rarely did they get one. And so if people were going to confront the perpetrators, one of the things we always advised them was, well, what if you don't get the apology you want? You know, what if you get all the blaming and shaming, and, you know, all that? And if they said, oh, well, then I'd be devastated, they said, don't do it then, because you're giving him the power to determine the outcome.
Yeah.
So, but if you just want to confront him because you want to say, this is your problem, not my problem, you know, this is your responsibility, and you will feel like it's a success just by
saying that.
Then, okay, you know, then we think
it's interesting because, in the book, you talked about this one case that went beautifully. I can't remember who it was, but, you know, the mother was able to apologize. And really, you said somewhere, it's not even the words, it's the emotion. In other words, it's like the experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was Rosie McMahon, who wrote a wonderful book that came out last year called Fortunate Daughter.
Yes, Fortunate.
Fortunate Daughter. I'm allowed to say this because Rosie's the one who kind of outed us. I was the person who worked with her mom and her parents, and my colleague Emily Schatzel was her therapist for years. But that took, I mean, Rosie started treatment with us when she was 12. She was 26 when she had the family confrontation. Yeah, she wasn't in treatment all that time, but off and on she was. So it took her, you know, it took a lot of work by the whole family.
It was wonderful, but you did say that it's often rare. And that's what I wanted to talk to you about a little bit.
Sure.
Well, all of us would like to have that, come to them, say, please don't interrupt me. Let me speak about the impact that this has had on me.
Yeah.
Both with the perpetrator, but also with the bystanders.
Right.
But the way that I see it from experience too, is that often the ones that have done it, not all the time, but a lot of the time, they didn't have the capacity to have empathy or feel how their behavior impacts another. How is that going to change today?
Well, the answer is, I don't know. And I don't think any of us knows.
I know.
We've invested so little in even first of all, most offenders get away with it. I mean, sexual assault, which is probably the least complicated of the forms of gender-based violence, your odds of getting away with it are about 99 in 100.
It's just so discouraging.
So, the perpetrators that actually face the criminal consequences are a very unrepresentative sample. There's much more psychopathology than what one sees in these guys who were, quote unquote, the pillar of the community. I mean, it got so bad that when anybody described a guy as a pillar of the community, I started thinking, oh, I know what he's up to. But and the only offender treatment that's ever been studied in any depth is with convicted offenders, because most guys don't volunteer. I mean, there's a little more data with domestic violence, but even then, most people, if they're not court-ordered into treatment, they're not going to do it. And the track record with sexual offenses is not very impressive. You know, with a wider population, if we ever got around to really studying sex offenders and holding them accountable and mandating them into some sort of reparative program, how many of them, we don't know how to instill empathy in people who don't have it.
Yeah, well, I've come to my old age as you start with thinking at the beginning, you have these dreams that they'll say sorry. But from my experiences, when I did personally try to put the words, I actually put the words in their mouth and it came back and it was like, those are my words, you're saying it means nothing.
Right.
Yeah. So I often just say, you know, they may not be able to do that, but you might be able to find empathy through other people that care about you, you know, be it a therapist, be it a great friend, or you're talking about a community.
Right. Right. I mean, that's why I think groups are so important for trauma survivors, because people often have much more empathy for each other than they do for themselves.
Yes.
And then we challenge them in our survivor groups. When they tell some of their story, they take a certain amount of time to tell their story, and then they get feedback. The other group members give feedback.
Mm.
And so they're not just telling the story for the sake of telling it. They're also telling it for the sake of being heard and really. And then after the, you know, when we model giving empathic feedback, but mostly the survivors in our groups are very good at it. You know, they've been there. They know, you know. And then we challenge the person who just shared some of her experience to take in the feedback.
Mm.
You know,
That's nice. Actually, take it in.
Yeah. Yeah. And not to sort of push it away. Well, yeah. But I'm different because blah, blah, blah. You know, whatever the reason. Good. So it's that recognition from a community, and even if it's a kind of invented community of a group. And that seems to work very well for survivors of many different kinds of combat vets, for refugees, for people who have been political prisoners, torture survivors. So again, it's the reconstituting a community where one feels cared about and that one belongs and that and validated and understood.
Yes. I was going to say in your book, I mean, the reality of the justice system is not always in favor of, I mean, even the way with the way that when a survivor comes to talk about what happened, they have so little power in sharing, and then the defense lawyer is all over them, and it's a traumatizing experience.
Yeah, well, I used to say that if you wanted to invent a system for aggravating the symptoms of post-traumatic stress, court of law would probably be ideal.
Really?
Because it is a hostile environment. Mm-hmm. As a victim, you don't have any agency. One of the people I interviewed for the book, who was a domestic violence survivor, said, "Make up your mind to the if you're going to go to court, make up your mind to the fact that you're just going to be a cog in something turning. And even though you know much more about the facts of the case than anybody else, you're just a witness, and just be prepared for your own peace of mind to throw any ideas you had about justice out the window." So yes, I think we can do better.
Let's see. There was so much great stuff. Just, I already mentioned it about the apology. And what did I write here about empathy? You were talking about, and you've already mentioned this, you know, what was much more important to survivors was having their voice heard. And, that was the piece that was important, not the, send them to jail or punish them, or it was. And I think we could really relate to that, because that's where the healing happens. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the people who actually did go to court, and six out of the 30 people I interviewed actually went through the whole criminal justice process to a conviction and a prison sentence, which is so rare. And they said the reason they stuck it out, because it was tough. Mm. It was very tough and, hard on their mental health. And
that's what I was thinking, re-traumatizing.
Yeah. But they stuck it out. They said, one said, I wasn't the first, but I wanted to be the last. I just knew he was going to do it again if he got away with it. And I couldn't live with myself if that happened. And another one said she'd been raped at a party by a boy she knew from high school. His father called up her father and said, "How much do you want? Can't we just forget about it?" Cops told her he'd done this to four or five other girls, and nobody would press, when they saw what was they would have to go through to testify. They were too, they just couldn't deal with it. And she said, "I wish, if one of those girls had gone forward, maybe this never would have happened to me." And so she stuck it out. And so I think he still got off, though, without a prison term, that particular case. The fine young man narrative, this fine young man, and, he's going to a good college, and
she's a college student.
A slut, and she was drinking too much at a party. And do you know what she was wearing?
Yeah.
So, the justice system can definitely do better by survivors. I think for people who are in subordinated groups, it's the the fact that the system supports the perpetrator, you know, the greatest outrage, you know.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And guilty, no, innocent until proven guilty. Like, instead of, I think you said this in your book, instead of like the impact, like that should be the first thing, but it's.
No, I mean, I do think in criminal cases, there's a reason why the standard of evidence is so high, and the presumption of innocence, because the state has so much more power. The state is pressing the charges. It's not a civil matter where one citizen is accusing another. It's the state, the prosecutors are the ones who bring the charges. So they have much more power than any individual. So, I mean, I think there's a reason why that's, you know, part of the Constitution, you know, and is to protect citizens from abuses of power by the state. But you can still have due process and give a lot more protection to survivors and a lot more support than the courts offer now. And you can, I mean, certainly the kind of hostile cross-examination that survivors have to endure, there's no reason why limits can't be placed on that. So yeah, there's a lot of room for improvement.
Yeah. So we're gonna come to a close, and I will put the book. Is it out on pre-order? Like, can you order? Okay, so that's good. And the date that it is officially released, do you know when that is?
March 14th.
Okay, great. This is the book, everyone. So good. And then I'm gonna get it on audio when it eventually goes on audio.
Yeah, there'll be an audio
book. Yep, it was just great. And I so appreciate your time. Is there anything you want to say just before we close?
No, I think we've kind of covered the territory. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was an honor and a pleasure to spend time with you today.
My pleasure as well.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.